Hi, everyone. This is Brian Kilmeade. You may know me from Fox News Channel's Fox and Friends and more, and the Brian Kilmeade Radio Show. Now I'm excited to share my new book, The President and the Freedom Fighter, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, and their battle to save America's soul. It's about the little-known story of how two American heroes and patriots disagreed, united, and changed the course of history and made America free for all. It's available now wherever books are sold.
The argument over the Democratic wipeout in Virginia. Nancy Pelosi keeps at it with the spending bills, and special counsel John Durham strikes again. We'll discuss all this more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined by Phil Klein and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. Charlie Cook is off on assignment. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are David Bonson's new book, There's No Free Lunch, and Made in Cookware. More about both of them in due course. If you listen to this podcast on nationalreview.com, including directly on the corner, we're delighted to have you, but it'd be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed at any of the streaming services out there, from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Phil, we got an ongoing argument going on about what happened in Virginia and how to interpret it. We did a flash podcast late Tuesday night when it was clear that Youngkin had gotten over the top. And we discussed some of this, but there's been much more argument the last few days. And you have a lot of denial on the left. You have a lot of people arguing, well, this was a racist dog whistle campaign that Youngkin was running because there's no such thing as CRT in the Virginia schools. So you're totally making this up. And then on the other hand, you have some extraordinary soul searching. There's this New York Times editorial, unsigned official statement by the New York Times yesterday saying Democrats can't afford to whistle past the graveyard here. This is a five alarm fire they're facing, and they need to realize, this is the New York Times, they need to realize that the party has gotten out of touch and gone too far left on a host of things, including the Biden reconciliation bill, which we'll talk more about in the next segment. But what do you make of it?
Well, I think it's pretty extraordinary in that most people, people were bracing for Youngkin to win. I mean, the polls seem to be heading in that direction. Many of us were being cautious because of the recent Democratic turn in Virginia. Ultimately, all the signs were there toward Youngkin. However, if you combine it with what happened in Jersey, which was on few people's radar, I mean, our own Dan McLaughlin had sort of told people to pay attention to the race a week before, noted it was closing in. But that was incredibly close. It's just that New Jersey is bluer, more deep blue than Virginia. But there was still a massive swing from last year to this year in New Jersey. And even you had the incredible story of the Senate president, the strong and powerful Steve Sweeney, who in 2017, his opponents spent millions to try to take him out. And this year, a truck driver who spent, by some accounts, I think $123 on his campaign, a guy named Edward Durr, he ended up winning and taking out this sort of lion of the Jersey Senate. And that suggests something different is happening, that people came up in this, you know, and instead of voting for the reliable Democrat, just voted for a Republican. And the big danger for Democrats is that there was always this question mark as Democrats made gains is, well, how much of it is due to the changing demographics or a shift in the country? And how much was it that, you know, there was Trump and that Trump was really unpopular? And what we saw in the results this week was that it seems like it's much more the latter, that basically Democrats for a number of years benefited from the suburban backlash against Donald Trump. And that once he was, and then they determined that they had a mandate to lurch far left. But it turns out that the particularly in Virginia, the state hadn't moved quite as far left as they assumed. It's still more purple than deep dark blue. And so what was particularly interesting is the question was, there were kind of two questions after the Trump, you know, or at least the intermission from Trump. We can maybe get more on that later. But basically, during this period, the two questions were, one, were Democrats sort of, you know, as some people say, were they renting suburban voters or buying them? Was this a long-term shift of the suburbs? And also, were Republicans, you know, gains in huge margins in rural areas tied to Trump? Or could that sort of Trump coalition, would they turn out without Trump around? And the answers to both questions were negative for Democrats. It looked more and more like the suburban vote shift that we saw during the Trump era was against Trump. Youngkin actually won suburban voters. And not only that, he didn't do it while sacrificing the rural so-called Trump voters. The so-called Trump voters voted more with Youngkin than they did for Trump. So this was a huge shift across the board. And it bodes very poorly for Democrats, because remember, even with Trump on the ballot last year, they, you know, lost seats in the House. They ended up with a 50-50 Senate. And then they took that as a signal to just go full speed ahead as if, you know, Bernie Sanders had won the election in a landslide. And I think that combined with all of these other issues, you know, the COVID lockdowns, school closures, the CRT stuff. You know, as I've written a number of times, the school closures were really the seeds of the whole CRT debate, and why that resonated so much were planted with the school closures, because simultaneously two things happened. One, parents became by necessity much more involved in their children's curriculum, much more aware of their children's curriculum. And secondarily, they learned to distrust everyone in school administration, teachers, unionized teachers, school boards, and, you know, superintendents of schools, politicians. So when it came to them saying CRT isn't taught in schools, suddenly parents are going to say, well, am I going to believe this person that's just been lying to me for a year and a half? These people who leap to the front of the line ahead of cancer patients to get vaccinated, only to decide not to show up to work because they didn't want to teach my kids. These are the people that I'm going to go on their word. And so I think it was a combination of a lot of things, but you know, particularly when coupled with Jersey, this wasn't a one-off thing. This was clearly people don't like Biden. They don't like what Democrats are doing, and they wanted to tell them to stop what they're doing and change course.
Yeah. So, Michael, clearly this is a national wave, right? You don't have a truck driver, former truck driver, taking out president of the state senate in New Jersey unless there's something happening all over the place. And it was evident in all sorts of races, whether it's court races in Pennsylvania or local races in Long Island, New Jersey, and Virginia. But you know, Virginia, something where I dissent a little from Phil, I think it's pretty blue state now. And I don't think that Youngkin necessarily would have pulled it out unless he ran such a brilliant campaign. But the key takeaway here from Republicans, as Phil noted, is being able to turn out rural, small town Trump voters in greater numbers than Donald Trump did. Without Donald Trump being on the ballot in Virginia, without Donald Trump showing up in Virginia, without Donald Trump being a factor in Virginia, except for Terry McAuliffe's forlorn obsession with Trump. And some people argue, well, that maybe that helped turn out Trump voters. Maybe it did. I doubt that was the overwhelming factor. At the same time, you avoid the downside that Trump had, which was repelling the suburbs, that made his path to victory very, very narrow. You know, and he got there barely in 2016. He didn't get there in 2020. And it was because he couldn't work both ends of this equation. The great promise of what Glenn Youngkin did is that it shows, well, maybe Republicans can. Maybe they can turn out those Trump voters in droves at the same time they take the edge off the Democratic advantage in the suburbs, or perhaps win overall among suburban voters the way Youngkin did.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing in the rural vote is basically the southernizing of the rest of the country, right? Where Democrats effectively get zero votes among rural whites, as they do in the South currently. Now that's creeping up. And it's important for Republicans, if they want to keep capitalizing on that, to make constant contact with those voters, because some of them were, you know, believed to be low propensity voters, disenchanted voters with the system. But these are the voters that came out and gave like Susan Collins a huge win in last year's Senate election, right? These people in Maine who, you know, maybe would vote for a Paul LePage or, you know, someone that was a little crustier than an establishment Republican. But they vote for Susan Collins too, if she's on the ballot, with an R after her name.
And this is one of the key takeaways from 2016 that some smart Democrats had, is that they thought with Obama and with Obama's coalition of the so-called ascendant that, you know, they kind of kicked away the rural areas and that was it. But they didn't realize there was much further losses they could still suffer in the rural areas. And that's what happened in 2016. Now we're seeing they could go down even further in those places.
Yeah.
And they pay a big price.
So it's important for Republicans to keep on with those voters. It's probably also time for Republicans to rethink any hurdles to voting, you know, that they might want to put towards in front of low propensity voters, because it might be that Republicans have as many or more of them than Democrats do.
Yeah,
right.
So this is a Botho turnout in Virginia.
Yeah, it was a massive turnout and it helped Republicans. I wonder, you know, one thought I had was looking at the results where you had basically a 12-point swing in Virginia and a 15-point swing in New Jersey that no one saw coming, is what if you'd run the truck driver in Virginia? Like right. Actually, was the Carlyle Group thing, right, the kind of corporate,
I hadn't thought of that, yeah,
ambiance, actually a net negative for Youngkin, but just not enough of one? It's hard to know, right? I mean, that's, you know, I think would be even beyond a David Shore level of analysis. But Youngkin ran a very good disciplined campaign. I think he targeted his message really well. I think we may be overstating the role of CRT in this and understating the role of COVID. Phil was getting at it, but I mean, a lot of Virginia schools were closed for a whole year longer than schools were even in New York. They had astonishing school closures. They had school name changes during the closures, so teachers and administrators could get together for virtue signaling politics, but they couldn't get together for, you know, teaching. Yeah.
Before Loudoun was the epicenter for the CRT fight, Fairfax County was kind of the poster child for a suburban upscale district that totally had failed its children.
And so you have that. And what you're seeing now after the election, I think, is Democrats backing away from COVID hysteria that, you know, Terry McAuliffe, according to the exit polls, the only issue set he won on were people whose top voting issue was COVID. But that was just one in seven voters. Meanwhile, like other issues like the economy and education have a huge pandemic component to them, right? Right, like we have supply chain issues because of extraordinary COVID measures. We had the school closures because of COVID. So now in the last day, you've seen the Democratic governor of Kansas come out against the federal vaccine mandate for through OSHA on employers with over 100 employees. And you've seen my own governor, Kathy Hochul in New York, announce for the first time an off-ramp for masking children at school, saying kind of vaguely that once a majority of children are vaccinated, she wasn't clear, a majority of 5 to 11-year-olds or a majority of 5 to 18-year-olds, which is a very different proposition. But maybe she wants the ambiguity. So there may be a serious back away from this because, you know, like one of the most obvious rules in politics, especially in a closely divided nation like our own, is that you're really better off tilting towards the center and towards independent voters and what they want, and not towards like your most, your basest base voters. And Democrats have done that. And so we'll see. I think, though, that they're almost in a trap. They're in the exact trap I thought Republicans would fall into, of being neither fish nor fowl. Because these results in New Jersey, New York, I mean, they are going to scare a bunch of House members who are new House members from the Democrats in New Jersey, New York, suburbs and exurbs. And these people won on the promise to restore the full state and local tax deduction. They are not necessarily the most progressive. They don't want to be associated with the wokest of the woke parts of the party in many cases. And it's not clear whether they're going to get the full deduction or not. Like, but you can see it's sharpening the conflict between the left and the moderates in the Democratic Party. And Republicans should press on that extremely hard in public. They should drive these wedges in further because there's limited time. You know, there is a possibility that this is the worst it's going to get for Democrats, that supply chain issues will begin to resolve themselves over the holidays. COVID restrictions are backed away from. And the economy picks up again, and there, you know, inflation disappears, turns out to be temporary, and then it's a much better environment for Democrats. Mm-hmm. It's possible that this is the low ebb. So while the getting's good, divide and conquer as much as you can now.
So Phil, let's dive a little bit more into the Republican divide over these results. You'll have Trumpy people saying, look, Youngkin won on cultural issues, he won on CRT. Sora Bomari argued this was actually a post-liberal victory because only post-liberals can tell government schools tell the government what to teach in government schools. I think that is a ridiculous argument, but there is a respectable argument that Youngkin was more culturally combative than he might have been learning from borrowing from the Trump playbook. Then there's the other argument, and this is where I'm inclined, that Youngkin, yes, he hit on CRT, which was very important. But as Michael is pointing out, education was a much broader issue. It wasn't just CRT. The beauty of CRT is it energizes conservatives and also has some cross-partisan appeal. But there are a bunch of issues that Youngkin hit, from school safety to academic excellence and standards and some of these elite schools, public schools in Virginia. And then it was all about parental involvement at the end of the day. And as you pointed out, one reason that McAuliffe made his original gaffe and didn't realize it was a gaffe until much too late was because he was saying something that basically Democrats believe. And the polling shows parental involvement in what schools teach and how they're conducted is a wedge issue, because Republicans and independents say, yes, parents should be more involved. And Democrats say, no, they should be less involved. So Youngkin made really effective use of that, and then also ran a really kind of practical lunch bucket, cost of living style, economic campaign that successful Republican candidates in gubernatorial races have in Virginia time immemorial. He wanted to suspend the grocery tax and wanted to suspend an increase in the gas tax and I think increase the standard deduction in Virginia. And none of that is anything that you need to be Trumpy or not to advocate.
Yeah, I think so. I think that on the question, the argument that sort of Trump showed the way, I think that there are you can kind of divide that into two issues, which is one, you could maybe argue that, you know, Trump kind of showed how you could energize a lot of these rural voters and, you know, as you were saying, you know, bring them out even more than they had been prior to Trump. So he kind of showed that this sort of coalition exists. And you could say that the certain attitude of Trump, the sort of not trying to be an apologetic Republican, being willing to lean into the culture war stuff and fight to win the culture war, as opposed to more of a Romney type who would sort of run away from those types of issues. You could argue that, you know, Trump kind of, you know, showed the path. But that's also a distinct question from what's best for Republicans going forward. And that is right. Whatever argument you could make for what Trump did in the past or how he may have changed the party positively by bringing in certain voters, whatever case you'd make from that perspective, you have to grapple with the fact that in the closing weeks of the campaign, Republicans and every Republican you'd speak to would basically say that Youngkin looks like he's poised to win this. He pretty much has this in hand. He's doing what he needs to do. But there was always that if, well, that sort of caveat of, well, what if Trump just shows up at the last minute? And Terry McAuliffe was desperate for this to happen. I mean, Joe Biden gave a speech in the lead up before the election that was essentially designed to try to bait Trump into coming. And when Trump put out a statement mentioning, you know, to people in Arlington, he'll see you soon, it was all the Republicans that were freaking out and the Democrats were chomping at the bit to be able to have that happen. And McAuliffe actually lied and said that Trump visited, even though he never did.
That was the weirdest thing.
He was just so desperate for Trump to show up and start talking about the stolen election and ballot boxes and audits and stuff for 2 hours, instead of making it about Youngkin and Terry McAuliffe. So, I mean, that kind of should tell you what's good for the party going forward. And I pointed out in a column I wrote this week that really, I think it underscores the importance of a real conservative running against Trump in 2024, assuming Trump runs. I think that, you know, he might not run, but he's acting like a candidate. He's doing things that people thinking of running for president usually do. So I think it's safe to assume by default that he's going to run. And he's not going to lose if it's one of these John Kasich, John Huntsman type campaigns. If Adam Kinzinger runs just a standard anti-Trump campaign, that's not going to win it. You basically have to have a candidate who is, you know, respectful enough to Trump voters and to Trump's role within the party, without buying into the 2020 stuff, but with having a very solid, unimpeachable conservative record. And as I noted in my piece, like, a lot of people might be afraid to challenge Trump because, you know, if you're let's say you're a younger conservative with a future, you might think, well, why would I go into the buzzsaw of Trump, lose, and then just get, you know, tarnished as this sort of Jeff Sessions type figure, this, or like a Jeff Flake, just sort of this anti-Trump figure that can't ever, you know, have a future in the party at all, rather than just wait 4 years for the Trump thing to pass. And then I'm still young enough to run. I think the problem with that is that, you know, you have to kind of strike when the iron's hot, and that presidential politics tends to reward boldness. In 2008, a lot of people were saying Obama shouldn't get challenge Hillary Clinton. He'll get eaten alive by the Clinton machine. There was even imagery of it being Hillzilla versus Obambi, and she was just going to stomp on him and his whole career would be over. If he had taken that advice, obviously history would have been different. He never would have been elected president if he just sort of said he'd wait his turn and run in, you know, 8-10 years later. So for me, I think that it shows that the stakes are too high. I mean, look at what Democrats are right now trying to do and ram through with a 50-50 Senate. If they just had a few more Senate seats and they got, you know, more seats in the House, you'd basically be looking at them. They'd blow up the filibuster. They'd pack the courts. They'd pass just trillions and trillions of dollars of all sorts of social welfare programs, Green New Deal stuff. It would be nonstop. And that's what they would try to do if they got that much power. And I think that the stakes are too high for Republicans to just sort of sit back and say, especially after Virginia, and you're seeing a different path, that somebody could do better than Trump in the rural areas and still improve upon his margins in the suburbs. And if you see that, you're looking at that, how could you turn 2024 and say, you know, we're just going to give the nomination to Trump and let him spend the year talking about the rigged election of 2020 instead of why Biden's a failure and what your Republicans would do better.
So next question to you, MBD, given the results Tuesday night, your guess at the House Republican pickup next year, will it be more than 10 seats, more than 20, more than 30, more than 40, more than 50?
More than 30. More than 30. I think it's going to be a strong election, but I do think the overall environment will be better for Democrats, just not good enough for them to hold on. I think the economy will look better. I think their supply chains will be over. Inflation will be down, and we'll be almost a year away from the Afghanistan withdrawal. So if you project from out here, I expect a strong, but not like a 1994 level result for Republicans.
I think that Afghan withdrawal, by the way, just can't be underestimated. I mean, that's what really, Biden was sliding downward, but that's what really pulled the plug out of the drain and got him down to 42% and some reputable
polls. I think that's also why they did it early.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah. So Phil Klein, your number.
Yeah, I'd say maybe over 30. I mean, and the only reason I say that is that the House is much more close. Like, you know, they don't need, you know, it's not like in 94 or in 2010 where Democrats had massive majorities so that they were able to win as much low-hanging fruit. Because right now, you know, it's 220, 212. So it's already close enough. I mean, after the 2014 wave, Republicans ended up with 241 seats. So if they won around 30, that would put them roughly in the same power as they had then. And I think that is sort of plausible. I don't think over 50 is realistic given how closely divided the Congress is right now.
Yeah, I'm also gonna make it unanimous, more than 30. I think if you held the election today, it would be around a 50 seat pickup, but maybe MBD is right and that Biden will float up a little bit over the next year. So I gotta go with the relatively cautious more than 30 at least for the moment. With that, let's hear from our first sponsor this week. You've heard us talk in the past about the Bahnsen Group, the multi-billion dollar wealth advisory firm led by our friend David Bahnsen that puts out Dividend Cafe and obsesses over integration of markets and policy. Well, David has authored a new book, There's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths That May Just Have a Little Something for Everybody. Written as a sort of daily economic devotional, David provides pithy commentary of 250 economic principles and quotations from famous economists and thinkers, and draws the reader into a deeper understanding of the foundational beliefs and applications around free enterprise. You don't have to be a PhD economist to understand this. It is written for those who instinctively favor a free market system, but want to better understand why. The book provides a faith-based worldview defense of free enterprise and does so with 250 single-page entries that will help you reflect, discern, and understand. There's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths from our friend, the brilliant David Bahnsen of the Bahnsen Group. You won't be sorry. Available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all good bookstores everywhere. So MBD, as we record here, mid-afternoon on Friday around 3 p.m., House Democrats are once again... This is a eternal Groundhog Day kind of effort they've been involved in, trying to vote on the infrastructure bill from the Senate, the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill, and the reconciliation bill, or perhaps just the rule on the reconciliation bill, just setting out the terms of debate, which is not the same as passing the bill, but they hope it'll at least be progress. And this goes to just a rival interpretation of Virginia. We're just talking about various ways of looking at it. Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden look at it. Well, you know why Terry McAuliffe went down? It's because we didn't pass the infrastructure bill. We didn't pass Build Back Better, which the voters of America are just hungry for. This kind of change, transformational change. We should have given it to them before Tuesday, but hey, we'll give it to them the Friday after the election.
Yeah, I mean, and even as we're recording, the situation keeps changing. Like we've seen reports, and you know, while we've been talking, that you know, there was a plan to bring the infrastructure bill to a vote to the House. Then the Progressive Caucus met and said, "No, let's let our six colleagues wait for their CBO score on that. We're not ready to vote for infrastructure before Build Back Better." So it's still the same thing where the progressives fundamentally don't trust that if they vote for the infrastructure bill, that Build Back Better will come to the floor. Meanwhile, Build Back Better keeps getting rebuilt. At this point, I actually think it's being built along the news cycle. Like I literally think the reason the $500 billion SALT deduction restoration was leaked last week was to get that news out for the Virginia, for the suburban votes, as people in New Jersey and New York were seeing where these elections were going. So I'm increasingly wondering if I've gone back and forth. I've been, I think, the most skeptical about their ability to pass them, but I still thought on balance they would pass both of these. But my faith is starting to shake, even though they're sometimes saying they are almost minutes or hours away from passing both. I think the logic of passing both has gotten harder to justify. And I think there are more moderates in the Senate even that don't necessarily want to defend this, and as details come out, they're not exactly like super popular. The daycare plan, you know, the plans for funding childcare came out today, and they basically said that they weren't going to fund, you weren't going to get childcare funding if you were funding care in the home, so you can't access those dollars for, you know, paying an aunt or a grandmother or, you know, an uncle to come in and take care of your children at home. And you can't use them for a childcare center that is in a house of worship, which is like half of childcare centers. If you,
crazy. I mean, this is childcare policy is culture war.
Exactly. I mean, and this speaks to actually a broader issue that I actually think is actually kind of scary, which is that liberals and conservatives increasingly see themselves as not even sharing the same institutions. And so as they attain power, they just seek to destroy those institutions, because that's what would happen is if you give a massive federal program to fund childcare, but deny it to, you know, say like the Presbyterian Church in my town, which hosted a daycare that was totally non-sectarian, you basically force that place out of business or to find another place. And you're also forcing an ethos on childcare, right? I mean, it's an attempt to extend the Deweyite neutrality of public schools down to 2-year-olds. So I don't know that they're going to get it done, actually, because they're, what you saw in the last, with these elections results this week, was there's huge pressure on the Democratic Party. And, you know, when they announced, say, the SALT restoration, Bernie Sanders flipped out. But that SALT restoration is necessary for these endangered New York, New Jersey, California, and, you know, and other Democrats across the country. That's a necessary part of the bill. A lot of people ran on that and got elected, won their primaries on that issue. But it might be too big a pill to swallow for progressives who want funding for other programs. So I don't know. I'm starting to think this ship is crashing.
Might be. We don't know what's going to happen before people hear this. Safest bet always is that these votes aren't going to happen and are going to get put off. But on the sheer politics of it, Phil, so I haven't looked at polling recently on the infrastructure bill. I imagine it's really good, but I also don't think people particularly care about the infrastructure bill one way or the other. The main political effect of it would be to give Biden a victory when he's basically had none for a very long time, if not the entirety of his presidency so far, at least a significant victory. And then Build Back Better, the Democrats, you know, if they're actually looking at some of this polling data, have to be concerned. There's an Emerson poll that came out today that showed more people think that Build Back Better will be bad for them than good for them. There's another poll, I think like a week or so ago, that had the same result. And this childcare policy, if people tend to really focus on it, is not going to be good for them. Maybe SALT is popular in the probably the most popular part of the bill for actually the people who would be affected by it. But they're just insistent that they need to double down and get it done. And even if they get it done, it may not work out for them the way they think.
Yeah. I mean, I think that clearly they've convinced themselves that the reason why they lost in Virginia was that they didn't pass Build Back Better and the infrastructure bills. This was a talking point that was pushed by progressives right off the bat. I mean, it was teed up even before the election in the pre-criminations. Then you heard it, if you were watching CNN or MSNBC coverage of Virginia, and then it just, you know, Joe Biden echoed it, and then it just became adopted by everyone. The question is, or almost everyone, and the question is, when you're dealing with a 50-50 Senate and not a three-vote, you know, to spare in the House, you have to get everyone on board with this idea. And there were, you know, a few rumbling, nerves among moderates. Manchin came out and he mentioned that he said that we're living in a center right nation. So that clearly doesn't sound like somebody who's eager to vote for this. I think that in terms of the popularity, they're not selling this at all. I mean, there was an ABC poll that came out over the weekend that showed 32% said that the bill would hurt them compared to 25% who thought that it would help them, and 18% said it would make no difference. So essentially by 2-1, people say it would either hurt them or make no difference compared to people that say it would help them. And this is before really a lot of the messaging has gone out on the bill and it, against the bill, because the Democrats say, oh, well, we haven't messaged on the bill. And to be honest, I think that's one thing that's helped our side, which wants to stop this train wreck, is that basically it might have made sense if they started from the beginning. Like even Obamacare, which I've followed intimately, it was all year was spent saying, like, we have to get down healthcare costs, we have to make healthcare more affordable, we have to do this and that. And obviously there were plenty of disasters along the way, but the whole debate was about, we have to change our healthcare system because it's not working. Had they picked like one priority and just said, we're gonna do childcare, and that's all they talked about is the cost of childcare, and that they basically, in every news story, it said, the Democrats' childcare bill, right? You might have seen like at least there was some coherent thing, but in this case, all we were reporting on is the $3.5 trillion bill. So that's all people basically know it as, to the extent that they're following this at all, is that Democrats are eager to spend trillions of dollars on a bunch of stuff. I compared it the other day to essentially a State of the Union speech in legislative form. You're basically just taking all of these bullet points and saying, let's just mix them in a cocktail and toss them in a bill. And so it kind of cuts both ways if they have something to show for it, because if they have something to show for it, then we're not firing at a moving target. One frustration that I've had as being somebody who likes to dig into the policy details of these bills is that there's no real bill, right?
What policy details, Phil?
Yeah, it's like, so like in Obamacare, there were each committee, there were 5 relevant committees. They were all holding hearings. They were
all those different
with draft bills. The House passed something, and then before the Senate, it passed. And that's how opponents like myself were able to really dig in and argue against a lot of it. Obviously, it didn't talk Democrats off the ledge, but it killed the public option. It really drove down the unpopularity of the law. But in this case, like, you're basically, the bill is, it's constantly changing. It's like a wiki bill, right? It's like, it's constantly updated. You have a press release one day and then Biden and the other day. You know, I wrote extensively about the original $3.5 trillion proposal. Then it gets trimmed back. I wrote about that, but now SALT's been put in it, and Pelosi wants to throw in family leave. And if you're a moderate Democrat in the House, you have to be out of your mind to try to vote for this before knowing that where Manchin's going
to
end
up. Yeah, of course. I mean, Pelosi is setting them up to have to vote for it twice.
Yeah.
You know, even if they succeed, and you know, they could vote on it twice and not succeed.
Well, it's not only that. Like in Obamacare, if you voted for the House bill, you would have had to vote for a bill that had a public option in it. If you in the Senate, if you waited for the Senate bill, you didn't have to vote for a public option, right? So I'm sure a lot of those, you know, Democrats, House Democrats who lost in 2010, wish that they could have like seen it play out first before walking off that cliff. And so I just think it's completely crazy. The difficulty that they're facing is that not everyone has consistent problems with it. The problems that Manchin and Sinema have with it aren't the same problems, and sometimes they're contradictory problems. There are also different problems than the House moderates have. And also it depends on whether the House moderates are from high tax states like New York, New Jersey, or from other states. And so there's a lot of these big problems. And I think that at the end of the day, I still have PTSD from Obamacare. And I always assume that at the 11th hour, like Democrats will find a way to spend a lot of money and raise taxes significantly. That's sort of in their DNA. But I would say that like MBD, I'm kind of, you know, part of me thinks maybe it wouldn't be, you know, maybe I'm not 100% convinced that it's going to pass. I mean, I've been telling people all year they're just going to pass something. And I think that we'll know really next month because, you know, there are all these phony deadlines that they're trying to create. But if you look at when things pass, Obamacare, Trump tax cut, it just seems like things drag on and then everyone wants to go for Christmas home and that ends up being the true deadline. And so I think that if basically nothing happens next, by the end of the calendar year and you end up moving into 2022 and that you see the number 2022 when you're filling out your checks and, you know, it's an election year and you're starting to think about your reelect. I mean, maybe then I think the odds go down, but until we get past Christmas, I'm just going to assume that they'll figure out some way to spend an ungodly sum of money on, a terrible, mess of a legislative vehicle.
MBD, exit question to you. Based on your sincerest possible political advice to Democrats, you would tell them to, among these options, pass BIF, pass Build Back, pass BIF and Build Back, pass neither.
Sincerely, they should pass both today and be done with it and go home and start figuring out what did I just vote for and what parts of it can I run on and how do I defend myself from the parts I wish weren't in it. Like that's sincerely the best option for them.
All right. So Phil, MBD is in pass both and pass both quickly camp.
I think the issue is sort of the common question of the difference between what's good for the Democratic Party versus what's good for individual Democrats. I think that for individual Democrats, it would probably, like if I'm Joe Manchin or a moderate Democrat, I'd probably prefer to say, I helped kill this large monstrosity, yeah, but I passed this BIF, you know, this smaller infrastructure bill that's more defensible to the, you know, average person. But if you're Pelosi, you're basically the whole reason that people are still sticking around with this 80-ish, leader is from her reputation of being the person who could get bills through and find a way to be this legislative genius, which I must say was built on a time period when she had 40 votes to spare. So I think that if you're Pelosi, you need to pass both bills for your survival. If you're a moderate Democrat, you probably want just the infrastructure bill to pass.
So I think they should, in terms of their own naked interests, they should pass both, but a radically scaled back, build back. So they can say they passed the build back and actually succeeded, but you know, just do the SALT, just do, you know, the expanded child tax credit, just do some relatively popular things and be done with it and move on. With that, speaking of moving on, it's time to hear from our second sponsor this episode, Made in Cookware. How does your favorite restaurant consistently make such delicious food? The short answer, they have access to the right kitchen tools. With Made In's professional quality cookware and kitchenware, anyone is capable of making restaurant quality food.
right at home. If you're serious about cooking, you should invest in your kitchen. Tools made in cookwares and kitchenware products are used by thousands of the world's best chefs. Here in the Lowry household, by the way, we tried their wine glasses and we love them. They're elegant and look great on the table. And most importantly, meet my wife's test. If quality and craftsmanship is important to you, you should check out Made In. Made In is a cookware and kitchenware brand that works with renowned chefs and artisans to produce some of the world's best pots, pans, and wine glasses. Made In produces professional quality cookware for those who love to cook. They source the finest materials and partner with renowned craftsmen to make premium kitchen tools available directly to you without the markup. Made In products are made to last, and they offer a lifetime guarantee. Their cookware distributes heat evenly and can easily go from the stovetop to the oven. They have 40,000 plus five-star reviews, and their products are used by some of the world's best chefs at Michelin-starred restaurants around the world. Made In, better cookware for better meals. Go to madeincookware.com/editors and use the promo code editors for 15% off your first order. That's madeincookware.com/editors, madeincookware.com/editors with the promo code editors. Please check it out. So we're running a little short on time. So we're going to go last segment here, just exit question style. I'll go to you first, MBD. Rate what happened in the Russia investigation in light of what we are learning from special counsel John Durham from 0 to 10. 0, this was just a game of telephone with some well-intentioned people that were legitimately alarmed about what the Trump campaign might have been up to and what Trump's loyalties were. 10, I should say, a hellacious fraud perpetrated on the American public. 0 to 10.
9.5. I actually think this is extremely serious. I think Republicans are stupid if they ever achieve the White House and Congress again and don't do major reform of the intelligence community and start cleaning house, because these have been turned against them in a way that, you know, if it were happening in Hungary, we would all know what to call it. But because it's happening in the Beltway, we think this is totally normal.
Coming on, MBD.
What?
I feel calm. I feel MBD calm. That could be a topic there.
I mean,
you're assigned.
This is,
if this had happened in Hungary.
If this had, we have found out that the charge that Trump benefited from these Russian connections and profited from Russian disinformation, et cetera, was itself part of a Russian disinformation campaign, but also that the intelligence used to open up the warrants was basically entirely the product of Hillary Clinton's campaign and other anti-Trump forces, that everyone involved basically knew this and went ahead anyway. This is legitimately like third world style behavior with the security services, or, you know, Bill Moyers style behavior with the security services. This actually isn't that foreign to America in some ways. And I'm afraid that Republicans will fail to put people in prison just as they failed to put Bill Moyer in prison for spying on Goldwater.
Bill Klein, 0 to 10.
I would say a 10. I mean, this really is a major indictment of the institutions of the Justice Department, the intelligence agencies, and the media, where you basically had the situation in which one campaign has misinformation that they used to peddle through Russian intermediaries into this spy who creates this dossier that then gets both fed to the media and then used as a pretext to launch an investigation into the campaign of your rival candidate, while your party is running the government, and the government that you had previously served in as Secretary of State, just so that you could you could simultaneously, you know, create this story that your opponent was under FBI investigation to collude for the foreign government, and do exactly what they attacked Republicans for doing after 2020, which is to erode confidence in our democratic institutions, spread the idea that, you know, basically the person who was elected was illegitimate and was installed by Russia in this massive plot, this massive conspiracy, and then to try to undermine his administration for several years through this investigation that was all started on a lie.
By the way, it also probably backfired in the sense that, like, you look at this now and you're like, oh, that helps explain. Comey was so freaked out that they had done this to the Trump campaign and Trump was going to lose, that when he had the chance to open up an investigation into the emails again the week of the election, he felt he had to do it. It's like, you know, like, all of this plays in. So yeah, this is...
I'm going to say, I guess, relatively low compared to you guys. I'm a 9. right up there. Maybe I'm a 9, I guess, because I make some allowance for good faith and competence. But otherwise, this is a complete outrage. Anyone with any BS detector or common sense knew the whole Russia collusion thing, that there was nothing to it from the outset, even if there are things they shouldn't have done. You know, Trump was saying things about Putin he shouldn't have. They shouldn't have had that meeting with the cutout from Russia. But still, the strong version of collusion was obviously always nonsense, and the dossier was obviously garbage. It should have been obvious to anyone, and especially anyone at the FBI. But instead, we had this thing drag on, create a special counsel investigation, which was Comey's intention, that roiled the country and kneecapped to some extent the Trump administration from the outset. So go John Durham. Let's keep revealing the truth and nailing people to the wall who broke the law. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, we're all so jealous. You had lunch with the great Jack Fowler.
Yeah, Jack is a shot in the arm. Jack is our former publisher at NR, and he is just a shot in the arm. And I'd been talking with him for a while about getting lunch sometime after he'd left us. And we finally did it today, basically in Rich's backyard, but without Rich there.
Guys. Jack, appreciate it. Appreciate you thinking of me.
I'm in trouble. I think Jack is in trouble. But it was just great. We went to a little kind of burger joint. It was a blast. Big shout out to Jack. And hope he shows up for the Christmas party and sings for us again.
So, Phil Klein, you are ruling the Jets season and looking ahead to next year. For no good reason, but you're looking ahead to next year.
Yeah, well, it's always this time of the Jets season, where you just start looking at mock drafts for the following year and trying to scout out, well, who's the top five in every position, since we have a lot of needs. But it has been, even, you know, as a Jets fan, where you're used to a lot of heartbreak, the last few years, and we haven't been in the playoffs for, this will be the 11th season that we will have avoided the playoffs. And, we had this Cinderella story last week where somebody named Mike White, who was our third string quarterback, was forced to make an emergency start, and he threw for over 400 yards. He smashed all these records for somebody's first start as a quarterback. His jersey actually ended up already in the Football Hall of Fame for this crazy historic performance. And so finally, you have kind of one guy to root for. They had a national game last night. Colt score first, then Mike White leads us downfield to tie it. Seems like he's picking up right where he left off, and then he gets injured. And so it was just sort of brutal and disappointing. And of course, we got crushed. Our defense didn't show up and so forth. But it's just, you know, being a Jets fan, whenever there's some reason for hope, you get disappointed. It's probably one reason why I'm always so pessimistic in my political takes, is that I'm always thinking like a Jets fan.
So I was down in Orlando, Florida for the National Conservatism Conference, the second edition of this national conference. They did the first one in Washington, D.C., and they put on a great event, I have to say. A lot of interesting people. I see a lot of friends there. I don't agree with everything I hear from some of my friends, but it's always interesting and stimulating. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
So my pick is Charles C.W. Cook. Has a piece, No, McAuliffe Didn't Lose Because Democrats Failed to Pass Biden's Left-Wing Agenda. And just with Charlie, it's not really just this piece. It's basically, Charlie has been, I don't know, transformed and on fire in the last couple of months. You know, he has a kind of an immigrant's love for America, which is very special and distinct. And he has a special anger and mourning and protective jealousy of his conception of America. And he sees the Democrats threatening it. And because of that, he's just been on fire for weeks. So follow Charlie.
Phil Klein, what's your pick?
My pick is Andrew McCarthy's piece, What to Make of Durham's Latest Indictment, and several pieces that he's written on the Durham indictment. We didn't have time to go into all of the details of it, but Andy McCarthy's been one of the indispensable writers on this story from the beginning. And if you want somebody to walk you through it, I suggest that piece and everything that he's writing on this unfolding story.
So my pick is Dan McLaughlin's Postmortem on the Election, which is incredibly thorough, that features an incredible number of colorful charts, the way only Dan can do them. But he studies this stuff really closely and just brings out a lot of important themes. So if you care about what happened on a Tuesday, and I'm sure almost all our listeners do, you really should read this piece. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National View podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National View Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. And speaking of sound, I should mention, I know I sound pretty echoey because I happen to be recording from an almost empty big room this afternoon. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to No Free Lunch and to Made In. Please check both of them out. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.